It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Tackling the controversies, engaging the culture, challenging the status quo, and taking your calls. Dr. Brown is the director of Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Call now at 866-34-TRUTH and get into the line of fire.
Have you ever heard it said that the only thing that really matters is seeing people saved? And if they're saved, that's all that matters, and nothing else really matters that much. And in the light of eternity, we can spend a lot of time that seems good, you know, helping the poor and feeding the hungry and doing all kinds of good works. But in the light of eternity, it's kind of a waste of time if people don't get saved. So should we engage in those things? Is that just a tactic that we use to get people saved? Or is living for Jesus in harmony with doing all kinds of good works? Michael Brown, thanks for joining us today. I'm delighted to have in our studio, in a hidden location somewhere outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, Tag Sanders, who has been one of our fire missionaries in the Philippines for a number of years. We'll probably take some calls, but I'm going to devote most of the show to talking with Tag. The number to call is 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884, or you can email me directly at drbrown@askdrbrown.org. And you may want to inquire of Tag in terms of things that you can do in your community where you live to make a difference. But Tag, thank you for joining us today on The Line of Fire.
Thanks for having me.
Tag, is that your original name?
That is.
So does it mean anything?
Not really. I've made up different meanings for it, but it really, my parents knew a man named Tag, and so they gave it to me. They blessed me with it.
Well, cool. You're the only Tag that I know.
Yeah, I met a guy the other day with a horse named Tag, and I know someone with a dog named Tag, but
yeah, and
that's
I
all.
I played Tag growing up.
Yeah, but, yeah.
All right. Now, what year did you come to our ministry school, Tag?
Oh, maybe 2000?
2000.
Yeah, I think I started in January of 2000.
All right, so you were a committed believer at that point, otherwise you couldn't have gotten into the school.
Mm-hmm.
When you came, what was your purpose in attending?
Well, I had been, I had encountered God pretty dramatically coming out of the rave scene and cocaine and ecstasy and those kind of things. And so I was just very passionate and wanted to go where God seemed to be moving the most. And everybody was talking about Brownsville at the time. And so I had a desire to get down there from almost day one.
Mm. So how old were you when you got transformed?
23.
23. All right. So you came to ministry school. You were passionate. You want to do something for God. Did you have a sense of calling or purpose or where you'd end up?
No, I didn't know where I was going to go at the time. My wife and I had just got married. She had been on several mission trips, and so I just kind of accepted that if I married her, it's probably going to be a missionary. And she liked Asia, so we had a hunch maybe Asia. But
all right, so then you became a part of a team, five couples, that you really shared your lives together, went through thick and thin together, and then moved over to the Philippines.
Right.
What year was that?
We moved to the Philippines in January of 2003.
All right, so not long after graduating. Graduated, got your feet under you.
About a year.
All right. And you were also the student speaker.
I was.
Yeah, in fact, my wife told me you did a better job that day than I did.
She
did. At the graduation. Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. You probably journaled it. But anyway, you go over to the Philippines. You have some concept of missions work, but it's a brand new world.
Right.
You're fairly young. Your team is all young in the Lord. You don't have anyone that's been on the field for decades.
Right.
So what did you guys do when you got there?
The first 6 months we prayed together every morning from about 7 to 11. And there were some high points and low points to that. We started to get involved in ministering in churches and really waited to let God kind of birth or form something in our heart.
So you didn't just go there, well, we got to get busy because we're missionaries. Missionaries,
right.
Got to have a plan of attack, got to have a 5-year, 10-year.
Right.
You didn't do any of that. You sought the Lord.
You're right.
Why did you do it in that order?
Well, that was what our team leader wanted to do. Praying for 6 months definitely wasn't, it was hard for me, but it was a really good time and really fruitful time. And I think a lot of what we've accomplished there is because of that season that we spent.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm 100% for that. Mm-hmm. Get your feet down, start to learn the culture, but then seek God. Now, did you try to serve other ministries, churches in the area?
We did. We actually had a vision to start a discipleship school that would serve the churches there. When we talked to different leaders, they all told us their greatest need was help with discipleship, and so we started a training center. But the training center actually grew more out of our own evangelism than it did out of other churches partnering with us.
All right. So from day one, winning the lost has been important to you.
Mm-hmm.
You've never backed away. Have you backed away from that priority?
No.
All right. So. Some things have happened, though, that have gotten you more involved in caring for the poor and needy. First, I want to hear what happened that got you on this journey, even from day one in the Philippines, mm-hmm. what your team's been involved with, but how you got the specific burden you have now. And then I want to talk about, is this a distraction from the Great Commission or part of the Great Commission?
Right.
So tell me about how you got where you are.
Well, when we started to feel released into ministering more, I had a more in my heart to go into the villages out of Matthew 10. In fact, Matthew 10 was my my strategy, to go in with nothing but the gospel. I would literally go in with one other person. We'd go two by two. The first time I went into a village, I felt like I was compromising because I took a cell phone, because you're supposed to take nothing in your pockets. But I was a little scared for my life at the time, so I took a cell phone in case I got in trouble. And
What kind of places were you going?
These were just... Very poor villages. There were city villages in the beginning, but they were still villages of Filipinos living in kind of squatter-type homes, bamboo huts.
Mm.
You know, some of the homes maybe 4 foot by 4 foot, 4 foot by 6 foot, people sleeping on the floor. You know, just really, really oppressive areas, really unclean areas.
What made you think you'd have cell phone reception in an area like
there,
that?
There was.
Oh, yeah.
The Philippines is the texting capital of the world.
That's true. That's true. So you started there, but you've been to some pretty outlying places.
Right, yeah.
All right, go
Which
ahead.
I enjoy more. We started in the city, and we'd just go in and preach or share the word and start a Bible study, and doing that in different places, we planted three different churches. Well, the third work that we established was farther outside of the city in a fishing village, and that's where I've been more involved for the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
But we did a lot with discipleship, a lot of, we've seen miracles.
What kind of miracles?
Healings and some pretty powerful deliverances. Just seen God do some really amazing things.
So you believe that there's still demons around today?
Oh, man. There's a lot of them in the Philippines.
tell us one story.
One story. The second place we planted a church was a garbage dump in the Philippines and other countries. Poor nations, the garbage dump attracts a lot of people to live there and, you know, try and make a living just picking through the garbage as the garbage comes in.
It's called Smoky Mountain where you
This were. One is a Smoky Mountain, yeah. There's a few Smoky Mountains in the Philippines. And so outside...
And they're called that because they're always burning garbage.
They're always, yeah, the natural combustion or the decomposition of the garbage produces a smoldering, smoking, kind of like a compost pile.
Okay.
When you open it up, it heats up. For whatever reason, they're always burning. They don't set it on fire, but they're always smoking and burning.
And people live there.
They live all around it in homes that are made out of the garbage or made out of just real simple anything that they can find. And the families, the fathers, the mothers, the children, they just attack the garbage as it comes in. They have these little hooks. They call it kahigging, which means chicken scratching. And they all, the first one that can get their hook into the garbage, that belongs to them. And so they pull out anything of value, anything recyclable, and then they save it. And then these buyers come and buy these materials from them, and that's how they live.
So an utter squalor and destitution.
Yeah, yeah. It was the first time we went there, it didn't even seem real. It was such a hard place. We went there and started Bible studies. Had two Bible studies that were growing, turned into a church plant. We have a school there now for children. But there was one couple there. Most everyone lived outside of the garbage, but there was one couple that lived right in the garbage. They had been dropped there by the city. Mm-hmm. They were mentally ill people, and the city didn't want them anymore, so they dropped them in the garbage. They lived in this home made out of the garbage. They smelled like feces and urine and everything else. Well, Mike Bailey, who was our team leader at the time, he went in there and he physically just hugged these people and hugged them and carried them right out of the garbage. And a group of people prayed with them for some time, and they saw significant deliverance, dramatic deliverance, and then there was dramatic change. To this day, they still live in the community there, in their right mind now.
Really? Praise God. All right, so from day one, once you started going out, you found that you were ministering to very poor people, mm-hmm. bringing the gospel to them, but that began to lead to other things that were on your heart. When we come back, we're going to talk about the call to love God with all of our heart, to love our neighbor as ourself, and then extraordinary story of how a new ministry has been birthed that could really help people in a significant way around the world. In fact, you listening can all be part of it. We'll be back. Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire today. Michael Brown, my joy to be having in the studio with us live, Tag Sanders, who's been a missionary in the Philippines with his family for the last 7 years, a part of actually our biggest missions team anywhere in the world in the Philippines. If you've got a question, practical question about doing good, about a ministry of mercy, about helping the poor, this is a good day to call 866-34-TRUTH. I'm going to be devoting almost the entire time to the discussion with Tag. I mentioned some wild news items yesterday that could wait a day. Well, they'll wait another day because none of them are time sensitive, but they are fascinating. So we'll, God willing, pick that up tomorrow. 866-34-TRUTH. We may take some calls, and you can email me by going to our website, askdrbrown.org. Click on Contact Us. Hey, we want to give a shout-out to one of our faithful listeners, co-worker of Tag's, but Eric Miller in the Philippines, man, you better not miss this broadcast. This is right. your moment of fame here. Okay, so the Philippines team from day one has been a team praying and fasting, been a team reaching out to the lost, making disciples, going for it in the roughest places. But you've also developed some real ministries of mercy, compassion to help people physically. And right now your focus is something called Christopher Farms. So tell us how this came to pass. How you got the vision.
Okay. Well, I was kind of one of the least project-oriented missionaries. I loved to preach. I really loved village preaching and seeing people come to Jesus and have an encounter with him. I had been working with a church in a fishing village, developing the ministry there, and it was growing. It was doing well. We had a team come from Canada that was helping us build the actual building that our church was meeting in. And while they came, they brought a couple of nurses with them and had kind of a side medical clinic. It was a pretty rough medical clinic. We had a police officer pulling teeth with a pair of pliers. And we actually had hundreds of people come out for this.
Seriously?
Yep, yes.
Did you have Novocaine for the
teeth
pulling?
No, absolutely no.
No. You had a police officer.
Now, when you get out of the village, you get upgraded. So if you're a police officer, you become a dentist. A dentist would become a surgeon. Yeah, like that.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. I better get off of that and let you get back to
yeah,
the story.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so we had this, you know, this all going on. We were feeling pretty good about everything. And this woman named Tata, she's a 26-year-old mother, brought her son named Christopher, who is a 5-month-old infant, and she brought him to the medical clinic, and he was, you know, obviously very malnourished and not doing well. The story was, and this is a very common story, that Tata had been sick. She had a flu or a cold of some kind, and so she stopped breastfeeding Christopher because she was worried that she would pass the sickness to the infant, which, you know, that's the worst thing that she could do is stop breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what she did, and that's what a lot of them do. And so Christopher had not been breastfed in weeks, if even a couple months. What they were feeding him was kind of a milk that they make out of rice. It really doesn't give the baby anything, but it's a common substitute for the ones that live in the village. There is formula there, but they can't obtain it. It's almost the same price as formula is here. And so those.
And how much would someone like this make? And if they're working.
Her husband
full-time?
Was a farmer, and so his income wasn't consistent anyway. But if he had income, it could be $1 a day.
Seriously.
If he had work.
And yeah, you're saying to get formula would be the same price as here in the States.
Same
so
price.
Completely
yeah.
impossible.
It's expensive for us when we were living there. Yeah.
Got it.
And so it's not an option for them. Some of them will buy a milk substitute, but it's not an infant formula. So anyway, Christopher was looking really, really rough. And we bought him some milk that night. The nurse that was there attended to him. And that night at the place that the team was staying, everybody's kind of talking about it, feeling really good that we'd gotten to Christopher just in time. Well, she brought him back the next morning, and he was looking really bad. They called us over to pray, and we were praying for Christopher. And I was praying with my eyes open, and you could just watch him deteriorate very quickly. We prayed for a few minutes and then decided to try and make it to the hospital with him. We put Christopher in my truck, and we had his mother and a couple Filipinos there with us and the nurse that had come from Canada. We sped down this dirt road trying to get to, it's kind of a hospital, medical clinic type place. And Christopher died about halfway there. About 10 minutes down the road, he died in the truck, and the mother didn't realize it yet. The nurse from Canada that was holding Christopher, she was hitting me while I was driving, and I wasn't sure if she was wanting me to go faster, slower. I didn't know what she was trying to tell me, then realized that he had died. We decided to go ahead and go all the way to the hospital, and we got there and found out that they had released Christopher a few days earlier because they couldn't afford payment or any kind of treatment. The hospitals in the Philippines, they require payment before treatment, no matter who you are. And so a lot of people die right there at the hospital. Well, now Christopher was dead. His eyes were still open. Rigor mortis had set in already. We couldn't get his eyes closed. The mother was just, as any mother would be, hysterical in the hospital. And we didn't quite know what to do next. I wasn't sure what the protocol was. I didn't know if we needed to file for any kind of certificate, if we needed to take him to the funeral home. But then I just started to realize how poor these people were. Christopher didn't have a birth certificate, so he didn't need a death certificate.
Really?
They didn't go to the funeral home. They just, bury him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were driving back to the village, and my heart began to stir with just a hope and a desire to see Christopher live again. And we'd heard of other missionaries that had believed for the impossible and seen people raised from the dead. So we took Christopher to a little bamboo house there and started praying and asking God for resurrection and just asking for his life back. And I was holding him. I mean, I just really remember this moment because this was a very transforming a day experience for me. And we were holding Christopher and praying. And while we were praying, it just kind of entered my heart, should Christopher be raised to only starve again? And that's when it hit me that Christopher did not die because of a disease. He did not die because of an injury. He did not die for any other reason that his mother couldn't provide milk for him. And his mother was a part of the church that I'd been ministering in for several years now. Christopher was the nephew of our Filipino pastor of that church.
Wow.
And I was hit with the reality that we had been ministering to these spiritual needs and not doing anything to help these people naturally and physically. And these are not lazy people who are just trying to get handouts. They're working hard, and they just can't feed their children. And Christopher died. That day I had a sense that I would never be the same, and that was a real defining moment for me. The next day, when we buried Christopher, we built a little plywood casket out of spare materials from the church that we were building. We did a little graveside service for him, and the mother was pulled away from the casket, she just collapsed, and she said in Cebuano, "If I only had milk, if I only had milk."
Mm-hmm.
And I just determined never to forget how I felt that day, and just seeing and feeling the pain of this mother. And out of that experience came a vision for this farm in his village called the Christopher Farm, to feed the children from his village.
All right. There are folks hearing this now, and they've got to be as moved as I am, even though I've heard it before. Just hearing it again is overwhelming. I want you to hear, friends, what someone with no experience or background in this area has actually done with a vision to save the lives of thousands of Christophers in the poor regions around the world, and what you can do to be part of it. Stay with us, friends. We'll be back and we'll talk through, is this really part of the gospel? Thanks for joining us, friends, on the Line of Fire. Michael Brown, delighted as always, to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH. Live in the studio with me today is Tag Saunders. Tag and his family have been serving as missionaries in the Philippines for 7 years. Our team there continues to grow. In fact, we lose some of our best staff here, church and school staff, to the Philippines. But thankfully, we've got missionaries around the world, and the Philippines team continues to do things that just amaze us. We sit back and see the reports and wonder, where did they get it? Because we didn't teach them this. They're just doing extraordinary things on the field. And before the last break, Christopher told us, Tag told us a moving story about 5-month-old Christopher died just for lack of milk. Terribly poor parents in the Philippines. And God stirred him as he was involved right there in the baby's death, even praying for him to be raised from the dead, that he had to do something about this. Friends, if you go to AskDrBrown.org and click on the line of fire, then you'll find a link to ChristopherFarms.org where you can find out more about what they're doing. And if you want to be part of it, the giving link there is not working, so we put up another link for you that'll actually tell you how you can stand with them and support. When you realize how much we have here in America, the thing is not to receive a guilt trip, but to say, wonderful, I've been entrusted with these resources. What can I do? So, Tag, before I get to the larger question, which is how this ties in with the preaching of the gospel, tell me the specific strategy that the Lord laid on your heart now.
Okay, well, you know, originally I don't know if it was so much a strategy the way it's developed into one, but just a response to what happened with Christopher. We started a farm right outside his village called the Christopher Farm, and the goal of that farm was to feed children in Christopher's village in memory of Christopher. And that his death wouldn't have to be in vain, but that life could come out of his death. And then that's kind of become the living parable of the farm and the other farms that we hope to establish, is that life came out of the death of this boy, and just as life came out of the death of Jesus.
What would you like to see happen? What's the faith goal that's in your heart?
Well,
we're faith people here.
Let me back up. On January, January this year, we started feeding 30 children daily in Christopher's village, and we added every month. My goal before we left the Philippines last week was to be to 100 children. And on May 3rd, we started feeding 100 children every day breakfast, Monday through Friday, off the farm. There's a little bit of a deficit I have to make up for every week, but we're feeding 100 children daily breakfast. We call it the Breakfast Club, kind of in remembrance of what George Mueller did.
Okay,
so we're 1% towards our goal. The big vision that's in my heart is to be feeding 10,000 children daily.
In the Philippines only?
Worldwide, wherever God leads us to start these farms. But not just from taking an offering and feeding children, but through creating farms that sustain themselves, that pay for themselves, and that produce enough food to feed children out of those farms.
All right, listen though, Tag, you went over to the Philippines with the goal of making an eternal impact by seeing lost souls saved. This world's going to burn up. Everybody's going to die anyway. Isn't this a distraction now from the Great Commission? I mean, you used to just be telling people about Jesus. Now you're feeding people. It's nice to feed them. I mean, it's good. But isn't it better to I mean, it shouldn't just be like preaching to the parents, and if the parents get saved, even if they all die, at least they're saved? It seems maybe like it could be a distraction. Yes, I'm playing the devil's advocate.
No, well, you sound just like I did about 3 years ago, until he died in my truck and until I saw his mother and until I felt the pain. And it's, you know, not just the emotion of it, but, you know, the reality is that God cares for these children, and God cares for humanity so much that he gave Jesus to die for humanity. And I think it's right to help humanity in his name. Just in response to your question, I'll tell you, the week before I left the Philippines, I visited the Breakfast Club, and they kind of honored me. And they had a lot of the mothers there to stand up and say something to me. And we originally started feeding children in the church, and then we expanded beyond the church to feeding children that are outside of our church there in the community. We don't tie any strings to it. They're not required to attend service. They just are part of the Breakfast Club, and that just kind of integrates them into the community. And then we encourage our workers that are working the Breakfast Club just to fellowship and share life with these people. Well, it started off with a few women from the church thanking me, and I knew those women, and they were just crying, and one of them even gave me a kiss. which was something.
Filipino
some kind
culture.
Of experience. Yeah. Uh-huh. But after that, you know, I started hearing from women that I didn't even know because the Breakfast Club had grown so fast, and they were from outside our church. Some of them were Catholics, and the Catholicism in the Philippines is mostly very perverse.
Yeah, it won't lead you to Jesus for the
it
most
won't,
part.
It won't get you there. No, it'll take you quite the other way. And these women were crying and thanking me and telling me thank you for loving my kids, even though we're not part of your church, and even though I'm Catholic, you love my children. And I have to tell you, I really like what I'm experiencing here, and I like this church better, and I like the life that I feel when I'm here. And these people are opening their hearts up to what we have spiritually because we've shown that we really do care about their children.
Mm. I'm going to ask a question to our listeners to think about. Do you think, and I'll ask you the same question, Tag, do you think that we make too much of a separation between the physical and the spiritual? That if you want to weigh in, 866-34-TRUTH, do we make too much of a distinction? Well, this is spiritual work. This is getting people saved. Whereas the physical work, I mean, that's okay, but it's really secondary, and it shouldn't distract from the spiritual work. Do you think there's a false dichotomy there?
I think I would have to come back tomorrow for that. Maybe the next day, maybe the next day. I had to recant a lot of my teaching from when we had classes in our discipleship school because I really taught what I later found out was Greek dualism.
Ah.
You know, it was really Platonic philosophy that I was teaching in the name of, you know, New Testament Christianity, and basically was teaching that everything that's spiritual is good and everything that flesh is you know, is bad.
Yeah, spiritual Gnosticism. Someone, I asked this question on Facebook, on our pages there, and someone made the point that it's what others have called an evangelical Gnosticism, that the only thing good is spirit, and anything physical, natural, is somehow bad. So you were one of our grads, and you were teaching that in the Philippines?
Yes, with tremendous confidence.
Uh-huh.
And it was through different experiences and even doing some research when we were looking at homeschooling when I started to see it differently. But, you know, on our website, we made our beliefs very simple on purpose. The vision of Christopher Farms is to feed children, and the farms are a living parable of that. Just as life came out of the death of Christopher, you know, there's real life that comes out of the death of someone else, Jesus. But we've kept our beliefs real simple on our website, and one of them is we believe that God created the stomach for food and food for the stomach, and the two ought to come together.
Uh-huh.
He created food, and he called it good. He created our stomachs, you know, for food to digest, and he created our taste buds to enjoy food, and he created those things out of his goodness. They're a revelation of who he is and his heart, and absolutely, I think that we separate the things too much.
And, you know, just comments that came in on Facebook earlier, if we love God and we love our neighbor, loving your neighbor is going to be tangible. And others have said, look, people aren't even going to listen to us unless they know how much we care. So, I mean, I think if we boil this down, and I want to chat about some other things after the break here, but when we boil this down, if we care about people, we want to do good. And the New Testament actually criticizes the attitude that says, oh, just go be warmed and filled and you don't do anything, right? So we care about people because we care. And we also know that this is a way to introduce them to the greater message of God's love. All right, stay with us. We'll be back. Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire. Michael Brown with my special guest, Tag Saunders, one of our missionaries to the Philippines. He'll be relocating back to the States so as to actually expand their missions work around the world, ministering in particular to the poor and to the starving. 866-34-TRUTH. Please do go to our website, askdrbrown.org, click on The Line of Fire, and go to the Christopher Farms website. Find out about what they're doing. If you want to support them, you want to help, monthly, one-time gift, we have another link for that, excuse me, since the online giving link is not working there. Question for you. A lot of people say we want to get people saved. Well, really, the goal of the Great Commission is to make disciples. When someone gets saved, truly, and they become a disciple of Jesus, is it possible to be a disciple of Jesus without radical change taking place in your life?
No.
Oh, okay. Why do you say no?
Well, Because I came from your school.
All right. Well, hang on. Let's a simpler question.
Yeah.
What? How did God impact you being part of Fire School of Ministry?
When God first really impacted me was when I encountered Him coming off from cocaine and ecstasy addictions.
Yeah, thank God.
And He became real to me, you know, and just encountering that real life. And that He was real, and that He started to live inside of me and transform me, and that he loved me and accepted me in spite of all the wicked, wicked things I had done. I mean, I got pretty wicked. And it was just in a response to that life, you know, and maybe it's just He who's forgiven much, loves much.
I understand that, yes. So when you came to school, and what did God do for you? You're a transformed man. You came to ministry school. What happened then?
Well, I was coming to school to be trained and to... you know, with a desire to go out and serve God somewhere and do something, and that's what happened at school, was just week after week of impartation and exhortation and encouragement and just learning about all these men and women who'd done amazing things for God. And
so would you recommend that others that feel called come and get equipped?
Absolutely.
All right. So Tag, preach to our listening audience, what does it mean to be a disciple? Come on, you're a preacher at heart. What does it really mean to be a disciple?
Well, you know, I think to be a disciple or to be a Christian, you know, I used to embrace or really think, let me change your question.
Go ahead.
What does it mean to walk in truth?
All right.
And for me, for a long time, truth was static. It was to have the right doctrine. It was to have the right answer. It was to believe all the right things. But when Jesus came, He didn't say that I have the truth or I know the truth or just I speak the truth, but He said that I am the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And to be of the truth for me and to be a real disciple of Jesus means to have His life and His character and the personality of Him being worked into who we are. Being of the truth doesn't mean that we always have the right answer. It means that we're revealing love the way that He would reveal it in the earth.
So if someone is a real follower of Jesus, then they're going to reflect His heart. Do you think Jesus was wasting His time when He spent time healing the sick and driving out demons and even miraculously feeding people? Was that only a demonstration of His power?
No, that was a demonstration of His heart.
Ah, all right. So the whole idea that He performed the miracles just to prove that He was the Messiah misses the point that He often performed miracles out of compassion. So if we're real disciples, which means followers of Jesus, and we're really walking in the truth, that how can we turn a blind eye or a deaf ear to the suffering world?
Right. I think, you know, with Jesus, when I teach our students out of John 1, you know, that He was the Word, and I sure don't want to get into any language discussion with you here. I'm intimidated to even bring it up, but I teach them that when it says that Jesus was the Word or the Word became flesh, that a better word for Word is heart, that the heart of God became flesh, and it said that, you know, He came from the heart and the bosom of the Father, and that He is the heart of the Father made flesh and manifested in the form of a person that we can see and understand, that this is the heart of God. They had the religion, they had the theology, they had the scriptures, and with all those things, they did not realize that, you know, He desired mercy and compassion and not sacrifice. And so it took the manifestation of Jesus, the heart of God made flesh from the bosom of the Father, you know, who no one else had seen, to reveal what the heart of God really was.
And the great ultimate lesson you get looking at the life of Jesus is God really cares.
God really
cares about the suffering world. All right, got a few more minutes. We come back. Stay with us. Thank all of you that commented on the Ask Dr. Brown page on Facebook. If you're not part of that family, go to Facebook, type in Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown, and join us there. But thanks for all the comments. Just spotted this one from Jeremy. It's easy to preach to those in need. Tell a rich, fat atheist that he needs God, then see what happens. You have to have a platform to preach from. Loving unconditionally is a pretty good platform. Tag and I, during the break, Tag Saunders, one of our missionaries for the last 7 years in the Philippines. When I say our missionaries, we have an organization, Fire International, that sends out and oversees our workers as they graduate from the school. We're just comparing notes on all the folks going over. My former assistant, Eric, and his wife, Jenny, with their baby on their way over. One of our faithful street preachers, standing up for righteousness for years in Charlotte around America. He and his wife and 8 kids on their way over. Two of our key fire school staff members on their way over. And others keep going over to join the Philippines team. But the whole team's doing amazing things. We're so proud of them. Our grads around the world doing amazing things. Often we're in tears when we hear the testimonies. All over America doing amazing things. But you've seen God really touch some lives there. Tell us just about the reception of the gospel when you go out in these outlying poor villages, and maybe one outstanding testimony of salvation that comes to mind.
Well, I'll tell you just something with ministering to people in the Philippines, and it's probably true in a lot of Asian countries, is it's important not to lose face. Mm-hmm. They're not a confrontational culture, and they will agree to anything to your face, and so it's very easy to go there and do ministry, to do evangelism, and to get agreement and feel like you've really accomplished something. But they, like I said, they will agree to anything temporarily to avoid you not being ashamed or they not being ashamed. But with what we've seen the most fruit in, and where we've seen people grow and change the most, are those places where we've been willing to go in and invest a lot of time and to love the people and to build relationships with them. And we've seen some dramatic conversions, like the couple I told you about at New Carmen. We've seen a handful of transvestite prostitutes.
And that came after there was a big meeting in the Philippines. I was there and some others, and a challenge came forward to pray and fast.
Right.
And your team really joined in to pray and fast for the homosexual community.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, transvestite prostitutes just started showing up at your meetings.
Yeah, we had some very interesting meetings where we really didn't know if they were going in the right bathroom or the wrong bathroom.
Mm. And they came to mock also.
They came to mock, but some really came to receive, because we were showing them love. We weren't just condemning them, but it was a challenge.
So bottom line, you've got to, and getting some of the pictures as they were getting their haircuts.
Yeah.
So you're talking about men that look like women. Some of them have been almost sold into
very much like women
sex trade, and didn't even have any men's clothing or undergarments. And yeah, we get the pictures as they were getting baptized, mm-hmm. with their hair getting cut and stuff. So bottom line, we got a minute left. To just knock on a door and walk away is not going to do it.
Right.
You got to get involved in the lives of people.
Absolutely.
30 seconds. Say something to our listeners, whatever you want to deposit in their hearts.
30 seconds.
30 okay, seconds.
Well, I'm down to 25 now. for me, and I've shared this before, but truth is who you are. It's not what you know. It's not what you say. There's a lot of people representing God, and they're saying the right thing, but they're saying it the wrong way. I think if we can major on love and walk in love, we can get a lot of things right, a lot of things wrong, but still be right. But if we say all the right things without love, we're going to get it all wrong.
American people have heard a lot of messages, a lot of teaching, preaching, celebrity preachers, all this, and what they really need is a demonstration of the gospel lived out in their neighborhoods. Tag, bless you guys for the example you've set. Friends, it'd mean a lot to me personally if you find out about what Christopher Farms is doing, but more importantly, you could be integrally involved in saving lives, both here and in the world to come. Go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the line of fire. Back with you tomorrow.